You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 261, Exodus 3, part 2A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Well, pretty good. We are out of the bad weather, out of the snow, out of the cold. Well, mostly out of the cold. But, so I'm liking it a little bit better.
Yeah, here in Texas, it's been pretty mild. A little bit of snow in the northern parts and rain for the rest. And but, you know, I take my cold weather when I can get it because we won't have it for long.
Did you see that there was snow in Las Vegas?
I did. I actually lived in Las Vegas, and
I know that's why I was bringing it up. That'd be weird.
I have some friends still there, and so it's fun to see their pictures on Facebook and whatnot. But when we lived there, it got one of the worst snowstorms in history, and it was amazing. I mean, it was crazy.
Wow, that's weird.
Yeah, it was very weird, but it's fun to get cold weather when you can, when you live in those hot areas. So I know our Las Vegas listeners are enjoying it.
Well, it's glad somebody is, because I've more or less had enough of it, you know.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. But you don't get too much of it being on the coast.
No, but, no. So it's not bad. It's just when I moved here, like I said before, you know, I just threw all my boots away, the shovels, you know, people, it doesn't snow here. And that was music to my ears after 12 years in the Midwest, you know. Yeah. And then I'm still looking for the person who lied to me. You know, it's just.
I hear you.
Oh, well.
Well, Mike, I need our iTunes listeners to do something for us, Mike, here real quick.
Oh, okay.
I need our iTunes listeners. This is for y'all only. I need y'all to go rate us, okay? You don't have to leave a review. It's just those stars. I'm telling you right now. I had to change the feed. We had some website issues. I got everything moved over and stuff. I need every single iTunes listener to go rate us, please. You don't have to leave a review. All you got to do is click those stars.
Click the little stars.
The little stars. That's all you got to do. So please, if you listen via iTunes or use that app, go do it for us, please.
Yeah, listen to Trey. Go do that.
Help us out. Help other people find us. That's all I need you to do for right now. And all right, Mike, I'm excited. Watchers, you teased us last week about maybe connecting some dots to some watchers. So please tell me that's the case.
Yeah, I know. There's going to be some odd stuff in here. So, you know. That's what people pay us for.
They do? They do?
Oh, boy. No, I guess that's why they listen. Okay. I hope they listen for more reasons than that. Well, yeah, we are in Exodus 3 still. You know, last time we did the whole Midian thing. You know, what's this about Midian and Horeb, you know, in Exodus 3:1, and we tied that into the Yahweh coming from the south traditions in the Hebrew Bible in four or five passages. So I'm assuming if you're listening to this now, you have listened to that, because I'm not going to repeat that. And I'm going to build on what we did last time. So if you have not listened to part one, you need to do that, or some of the stuff here is going to be lost on you. But we want to focus this time on the Kenite. That's K-E-N-I-T-E, the Kenite hypothesis. And since the Kenites, as a people, kind of obscure in the Old Testament, are tied to the lineage of Cain, it's kind of interesting to, you know, take a rabbit trail, a sidebar, in the second half toward how the Book of Enoch looks at the genealogy of Cain, and specifically in relationship to linking Cain, you know, to evil and the watchers and so on and so forth. So we're going to do two things in this episode. We're going to talk about the Kenites and the Kenite hypothesis, explain what that is and what the implications are, at least how they're perceived. And then second part, we're going to do some of the Enochian crossover here into the lineage of Cain. I think you'll find it interesting. I think you'll find both parts interesting, actually. So to jump in here by way of introduction, what is the Kenite hypothesis? This goes back to the late 1800s, when a few scholars sort of drew attention to the Kenites and their lineages and how it overlaps with Midian, the Midianites. And then, of course, that takes you into an overlap with Moses and Jethro and all the things we talked about in part one. And once you do that, there, you know, it raises a question about, well, is it possible that that Moses, I mean, I'm going to use critical scholar speak here. Okay. You know, scholars who, and when I say critical, I'm not referring to critical thinking, because all scholars, hopefully, you know, will use critical thinking. But critical scholarship is typically one that does not have a necessarily high view of Scripture and is probably non-confessional. You know, they don't assign any concept of inspiration, for example, to the text. And that's especially true when critical scholarship starts to come into its own, the late 19th century, early 20th century, and so on. It was about, again, around that time, late 19th century, that a few scholars raised the question based upon the Kenite, Midianite, Moses connections. Well, in view of the fact that Moses apparently, that's an important term, we're going to hit this next episode, apparently did not know the name of Yahweh. You know, we get that from Exodus 6:3. Typically, the way it's translated, it's pretty explicit there, where God says to Moses, "By my name Yahweh, I did not reveal myself to them, to the patriarchs." And then you get Exodus 3, where Moses says essentially, "Hey, what's your name?" You know, in his conversation with God, and God says, "I am that I am." Okay, this is where the divine name comes from. So, certain scholars raise the question: well, maybe the Midianites worshipped Yahweh before the Israelites did, and Moses had to learn Yahweh religion from Jethro and from the Midianites and from the Kenites. Now, this sort of picked up steam later on when there were a couple of archaeological discoveries that did locate the divine name in artifactual evidence in these areas, these geographical areas where the Midianites and the Kenites come from. And so the Kenite hypothesis has sort of been I don't know if it's probably overstated to say it's a big deal, because there are a lot of scholars who don't buy it because they don't think Moses was at all historical. So that just sort of throws the whole thing out the window from the get-go. But it's still something that gets talked about in biblical scholarship. So by way of a sort of a well-written definition or overview, I'm going to read from Harper's Bible Dictionary here about the Kenites to get us into this whole, you know, what is this hypothesis? How does it work? And HBD says, the Kenites, or an ethnic group listed among the pre-Israelite inhabitants of the land of Canaan. So again, prior to the conquest, that means that there were people in the land called Kenites. Okay. Their name, continuing with HBD, their name is popularly derived from smith, as in like blacksmith, Hebrew Kayan, Kayan Kenite. Okay, you can hear the similarity there. A theory supported but not proven by the fact that the Kenites lived in northern Sinai, a region of copper mining and smelting in ancient times. Then he gives the reference of Numbers 24:17-22. Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, or Hobab, a priest of Midian, is identified in Judges 1:16 and Judges 4:11 as a Kenite. I'll read you Judges 1:16. The descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up with the people of Judah from the city of palms into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev near Arad, and they went and settled with the people. Let me just look up Judges 4:11. We can read that one as well. We might as well, since we're here. Judges 4:11. Now Heber, the Kenite, had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses. Okay, that's the first part of the verse. So it's pretty explicit, pretty clear that you've got, again, the priest of Midian, Jethro, who's, you know, part of the Kenites. Well, of course, Moses marries into that family in the Exodus story. So back to HBD. In view of the fact that Moses first encountered Yahweh in the service of the priest Jethro, and since Jethro later blessed Moses and offered sacrifice to Yahweh and instructed Moses regarding delegation of authority, this is Exodus 18, it has been speculated by some scholars that Moses learned Yahwism from the Kenites, the so-called Kenite hypothesis. The evidence, however, is not adequate to support this view. So let me just stop there. HBD, again, is being honest with us that there are a lot of people who just don't buy this. And again, we'll get into sort of why, for what reasons they might not. Continuing with HBD, some Kenite families evidently accompanied the Israelites to the plains of Moab, for the descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms, presumably Jericho, with the men of Judah to live among the people of the wilderness of Judah in the Negev near Arad. That's Judges 1:16. One Kenite family from this Negev community, Heber and his wife Jael, or Yael, it's J-A-E-L in English, migrated north to settle in Za'ananim near Kadesh, probably just northeast of Mount Tabor. And Jael subsequently killed Israel's enemy Sisera in her tent. This is the famous story in Judges 4 and 5. In Saul's campaign against the Amalekites of northern Sinai, he sent word to the Kenites to separate themselves from the Amalekites. Saul wanted to spare the Kenites since they had shown kindness to all the people of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. Okay, so that's 1 Samuel 15:6. And so when Saul is going to campaign against the Amalekites, he tells the Kenites to get out of Dodge, because he perceives the Kenites, again, as being kind to Israel when Israel came up out of Egypt. So even Saul knows at this point that there's some relationship between the Kenites and the Israelites. Now, I want to also quote a little bit from an article, and I'll put this in the protected folder. Marlene Mondrian, her article is entitled, Who Were the Kenites? This is from Old Testament Essays, Volume 24, Number 2, in 2011. She writes, the Kenite hypothesis postulates that Moses was introduced to the cult of Yahweh before he was confronted by Yahweh from the burning bush. Scholars in support of the Kenite hypothesis advance that these nomadic peoples from the regions south of Palestine venerated Yahweh even before tribes migrating or escaping from Egypt were introduced into the cult of Yahweh. And by the way, as I mentioned before in the podcast, when you read the word cult in scholarly literature, you can substitute the word worship. Okay, that's all it means. It's not like a cult like we think of, but cult refers to ritual acts. So the worship of Yahweh. Back to Mondrian. In Numbers 24, 21 to 22, the name Cain is specifically associated with the Kenites. Now, that's going to be important. Again, Cain is associated with the Kenites, Kenites with Cain. Scholars have identified the Cain narrative of Genesis 4 as the possible etiological legend of the Kenites. Etiological is a word that means point of origin. And Cain, they've identified Cain as the eponymous ancestor of these people. In other words, the ancestor whose name they bear. Continuing with Mondrian, although presently not so much in the forefront of scholarly debates, the question of the origin of the Yahwist religion of the Israelites has as yet not been resolved. Scholars have thus reached no consensus regarding this contentious matter. So again, that's a nice way of saying, hey, you know, this is a debate within scholarship. Now, there are questions raised in brief from those short summaries. I want you to be thinking about these questions. Is it coherent to say that Moses got Yahweh religion from the Kenites? Okay, that's question number one. Question two, is it coherent to say that the Kenites introduced the worship of Yahweh to Moses? And third, are the Kenites scripturally and etymologically connected to Cain? So those are three questions to sort of have in your head as we start here. I'm going to propose some other questions about what the implications of certain answers might be, you know, for a person like, you know, the people who listen to this podcast, those of us with a high view of Scripture. You know, does any of this matter? And I'll propose a few questions, you know, momentarily here related to those kinds of issues. So just so we understand, though, when scholars raise these questions, they are not just fabrications. Okay, they're not just sitting there at their desks thinking, well, you know, how can I like call the Bible into question? You know, what can I sort of suck out of my thumb, you know, to, you know, make the face value story of the Old Testament to make that appear like it's not what it's supposed to be. That's not what they're doing here. These are questions that arise from the text. Specifically, the questions are raised by Exodus 3, which is the revelation of the name, the divine name to Moses in the region of Midian associated with the northern Sinai Peninsula, the area of Paran, Timon, Edom, again, where certain biblical passages have Yahweh coming from. And Habakkuk 3:3-7, like we saw in the last episode, specifically loops Midian into that complex of ideas and that geography. There's also Exodus 6:3. Again, the way the verse is usually translated, it seems clear that Moses had never heard of the name of Yahweh. So that generates, you know, this issue, this question. And thirdly, there is ancient material that shows the name Yahweh was known in the area of Edom and Midian. Now, as we talked about last time, these texts date to the 1300s BC or the 1200s BC, either nearly a century earlier than the time most scholars have the Exodus. Remember the late date? Late dates in the 1200s. So if you're taking the late date, which most scholars do, and you find an inscription, an Egyptian text, that has the name Yahweh in it, and, you know, that's going to raise questions. Well, you know, they're not in the land yet, because one of those Egyptian inscriptions specifically situates, you know, Yahweh, or, you know, of the Shasu Bedouin in the land of Yahweh, and in Seir, which is, you know, again, one of the place names where Yahweh comes from the south, Seir, Edom, okay, Paran, Teman, this area. So if you look at that evidence, you're going to be thinking, good grief, it looks like Yahweh was known earlier than the Exodus and not by the Israelites. I mean, it's a very logical question to ask. So again, they're not sitting there at their desk just thinking up ways to, you know, justify tenure or something, okay? These are real questions. Now, just to rehearse the DDD evidence a little bit more, there are two Egyptian texts. I'm going to read again from DDD like I did last time. There are two Egyptian texts that mention Yahweh. In these texts, again, 1300s, 1200s, Yahweh is neither connected with the Israelites, nor is his cult, again, his worship, located in Palestine, Canaan. Okay. The texts speak about Yahu in the land of the Shasu Bedouins. The one text is from the reign of Amenophis III, that's the 1300s, and the other from the reign of Ramses II, that's the 1200s. In the Ramses II list, where this name, this place name occurs, the name occurs in a context which also mentions Seir. It may be tentatively concluded that the Yahu in the land of the Shasu Bedouins is to be situated in the area of Edom and Midian. Again, this is why it's a question. Now let's get into the data here about the Kenites themselves. Now, Mondrian writes this in her article. The Kenites were a nomadic or semi-nomadic tribe of coppersmiths. Think, just hold that thought in your head, coppersmiths, people who work with metal, okay? Who inhabited the rocky country south of Tel Arad, which was an important city in the eastern Negev. As early as the 13th century BCE, they made their livelihood as metal craftsmen. Scholars have identified the Cain narrative of Genesis 4, again, as the possible ideological, you know, reference point to this. Now, if I go back to the HBD article, okay, remember that I read this line earlier. The Kenites are an ethnic group listed among the pre-Israelite inhabitants of the land of Canaan. Their name is popularly derived from smith, okay, like a blacksmith, or, you know, again, someone who works with metal, Hebrew kain. So what we have here, right off the bat, in the name Kenite, which is spelled in Hebrew characters, I'll just give you the English letter names, Q-Y-N-Y. The name is Q-Y-N, Kyan, and then the Y on the end is called in Hebrew grammar a gentilic ending. It's a, you'd stick that little consonant there to turn a name into a people group. Okay, that's essentially what gentilics are. So you have Q-Y-N, Y-ending, Kenites. The name Cain is exactly the same minus the gentilic ending. It's Q-Y-N, Cain. So again, people who are working in the Hebrew text, they notice this immediately. Now, Rick Hess, and again, we interviewed Rick back at our series of SBL interviews, and Rick's specialty is actually personal names in ancient texts, not just Hebrew, but, you know, in Canaanite, Amorite, you know, he has a number of books and articles specifically on personal names and topographical, you know, place names. This is his thing. So in Anchor Bible Dictionary, Hess wrote the article on Cain, and he writes this. Cain appears in Genesis 4 as the murderer of his brother Abel and as the progenitor of a line credited with the initiation of various aspects of culture. The name recurs in the Oracle of Balaam at Numbers 24:22 in a difficult text which associates Cain, Kyan, with the Kenites, again, Q-Y-N-Y. The name of Cain has its etymological root, Q-Y-N, which does not appear other than in proper names and gentilics in biblical Hebrew. A similarly spelled root occurs in South Arabian. Okay, there we go. South Arabian personal, clan, and tribal names as early as the 5th century BC. And so we have a bit of a chronological disconnect there, but this is where you get this kind of naming terminology in that part of the region. A QYN root occurs in later Aramaic and Arabic with the meaning of smith, again, someone who works with metal. Furthermore, a similar root appears in the gentilic with which the Balaam oracle associates the name Cain and Cainites. These people appear in the biblical text as smiths associated with the desert area of Israel's wanderings. Okay, so there we, you know, again, this is all biblical data. Hess concludes with this line here. Compare Tubal Cain, the last mentioned figure in the line of Cain. He not only possesses Cain's name, but he is also described in the verse as a smith, again, someone who works with metal. So again, the biblical data are there. Back to Mondrian. Mondrian, again, just a brief note here. She says, according to Exodus 3:1, which is, again, where we're parked, and Judges 1:16, there is a clear connection between the Midianites and the Cainites. Exodus 3:1 refers to Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, as a priest of Midian, while Judges 1:16 names him as a Cainite. Cain and the Cainites are also linked in Judges 4:11. Where Heber the Cainite is said to have separated from Cain, he's also identified with the sons of Hobab, the Cainite or Midianite, the father-in-law of Moses. So it really seems, again, that the biblical data are pretty clear as far as these connection points anyway. And the location of the Cainites, again, in the southeast, on the border of where, you know, Judah would be in the south of Canaan, right there, you know, where if you're under, again, the Dead Sea, when you start to move under the Dead Sea, you run into Edom. So there's this fuzzy border again. And of course, you know, south of Canaan, this is the region of Timon and Paran. And we saw last week, again, in Habakkuk 3, that this sort of area is still connected with the Midianites, you know, in some way. Again, you get this picture that, you know, all of these things converge again. And so once this archaeological data was discovered, you know, with again, since most scholars take the late date of the Exodus, when you have Yahweh specifically said by an Egyptian to be a place name that includes the name Yahweh in this area, you know, in the time of Ramses, okay, then you have to wonder because, you know, even if let's just say I'm a late dater and I think the Exodus happened in the reign of Ramses. Again, there are problems with that. We've talked about them in several episodes already. But let's just throw it out there. You know, let's say the movie Ten Commandments that's the right thing. It's still only going to be much later before the Israelites actually get into the land. I mean, you have to have the conquest. I mean, you at least have an encounter with Moses, but. But when you read, again, the biblical text at face value, when Moses shows up in Midian and he meets Jethro and, of course, you know, his daughters, it's like they already know this. They already know the name Yahweh. So, you know, what Ramses, whoever wrote this text from the time of Ramses, it would seem that this was already a place that the Egyptians knew too. The Egyptian army and Ramses aren't in Exodus 3. They're not scouting out Midian and run into the name of Yahweh. It's already there. So again, these things just create these questions. So our sources, again, at least biblically, seem pretty clear to create these associations. But I've already mentioned that some scholars just don't buy, you know, into the connection. So we ought to say something about why before we go any further. You know, it seems kind of obvious. So why would this be a debate? At you know, just we'll take out the whole, you know, chicken or egg, you know. Did Moses know Yahweh? Theological question, if it even is a theological question. We'll get to that in a moment too. But let's just put that to the side of the table here. If we're a bunch of scholars and we don't really care, you know, if what we think conforms to, you know, the Bible alone, or you know, we don't have a high view of Scripture, something like that, okay? And we're just looking at the data. Why would anybody doubt it? You know, the hypothesis anyway. Well, fundamentally, some scholars doubt, and here's a key word, they doubt a historical connection between the Kenites and Cain. They say, yeah, I know the Bible, there's a Bible verse for that. But they don't consider Cain real, they don't consider Moses real, and so they just think that the verse is kind of made up. They don't consider any of this historical. They believe the biblical writer just heard the same sound between, you know, the literary name Cain and then ran into some Kenites and heard their name or knew the people group name and just sort of made up a connection in the biblical text. They don't think any of it's historical, it's just literary and made up. So that's why they don't really care about the hypothesis. They don't put any stock in it in terms of real history. You know, and some of them even doubt that the Yahweh references in Egyptian texts. They think that, okay, there's a place and it has these consonants in it, YHW. That doesn't mean there was a religion of Yahweh there. You can't just take the occurrence of a name and say there's a whole system of worship there. And they're right on that point. You really can't do that. You can't take a place name and assume that there's a deity there who's worshipped and has a priesthood and a cult. You know, that exaggerates, that way overstates the data, because the data is like two texts, okay? And only one of them actually puts them in Seer, okay? So they're right. I mean, the people who are doubting this are right at this point. They just don't think there's enough data to make these connections. Plus, they don't consider it, you know, historical anyway. And so they just don't assign a whole lot of importance to it. Who cares if the Kenites come from Cain? The Hebrew Bible is still pretty clear. The Kenites were related to the Midianites. And so the Yahweh from the south of Canaan stuff, you know, Seir, Edom, Paran, Teman, these scholars would say, well, that's still valid. I mean, because there's other things going on here in this Yahweh from the south tradition. That's pretty obvious. But why do we have to come up with this Kenite hypothesis about where the worship of Yahweh, the worship of Yahweh comes from? They'd argue that where our attention needs to be, again, is in the general Yahweh from the south stuff, and not really obsessing about which people group, you know, told Moses, you know, again, because they don't believe there was a Moses. We don't really need to care about distractions like this. Let's just look at the Yahweh from the south traditions and go from there. Now, I'm going to illustrate for you kind of how this works. And I'm going to quote from Van der Torn's article in DDD. This is his article on Yahweh, because it spends some time on the Kenite thing. And you'll just see how Van der Torn is a guy who, he knows all the data. He's not going to be a believer in the historicity of Moses. I mean, I don't want to say for sure that I know that, but I mean, I've only met the guy once, so I can't really tell. But if he's sort of a mainstream European scholar, that, you know, 9 chances out of 10, I'm going to be right here. He doesn't assign historicity to Moses, but he recognizes all the data. So how would he talk about this? Okay. And that's what the DDD entry, at least this part of it, is good for. Just how do they think about this? So he writes, before 1200 BC, the name Yahweh is not found in any Semitic text. That's true. Yahweh was not known at, it's true if you exclude the Bible, okay? Yahweh was not at Ugarit either. I get email questions about this all the time. What about, you know, Yahweh came from the Ugaritic stuff and Ugarit? No, he didn't. He just didn't. There's like one guy in the world who claimed this and I think is still alive. Nobody buys that. All right, and this is a good example. Van der Torn is not an evangelical Bible believer that thinks the Bible's inspired. He thinks that's just silly. Okay, so let's jump back in here. Yahweh was not known at Ugarit either. The singular name YW, vocalization unknown, in a damaged passage of the Baal cycle cannot convincingly be interpreted as an abbreviation for Yahweh. The earliest West Semitic text mentioning Yahweh, again, except for the biblical evidence, is the victory stela written by Mesha, the Moabite king from the 9th century BCE. That's the Moabite stone. The absence of references to a Syrian or Palestinian cult of Yahweh outside Israel suggests that the god does not belong to the traditional circle of West Semitic deities. The origins of his veneration must be sought for elsewhere. A number of texts suggest that Yahweh was worshipped in southern Edom and Midian before his cult spread to Palestine. Again, Palestine is politically correct terminology for Canaan here, for Israel as a land. There are two Egyptian texts that mention Yahweh. In these texts from the 14th and 13th centuries BCE, Yahweh is neither connected with the Israelites nor is his cult located in Palestine. Again, we read those before. So he says here, in these texts, YHW is used as a toponym, place name. Yet a relationship with the deity by the same name is a reasonable assumption, but whether the god took his name from the region or vice versa remains undecided. By the 14th century BCE, before the cult of Yahweh had reached Israel, groups of Edomite and Midianite nomads worshipped Yahweh as their god. And he's saying this is apparently what's going on. These data converge with a northern tradition. North of Edom and Midian would be in Canaan proper. Okay. These data converge with a northern tradition found in a number of ancient theophany texts, according to which Yahweh came from Edom and Seir. Judges 5, Psalm 68, Deuteronomy 33, Habakkuk 3. Again, we've been over all this turf. All of those places in those passages, Van der Torn writes, Seir, Mount Paran, Timon, and Sinai are in or near Edom. If Yahweh was at home in the south then, because Edom is south of Palestine or Canaan, how did he make his way to the north? Like how did it, if it started here, how did it migrate north? According to a widely accepted theory, the Kenites were the mediators of the Yahwistic cult. In its classical form, the hypothesis assumes that the Israelites became acquainted with the cult of Yahweh through Moses. Moses' father-in-law, Hobab, according to an old tradition, was a Midianite priest who worshipped Yahweh. Again, Exodus 18, Exodus 3, all that stuff. He belonged to the Kenites, Judges 1:16 and 4:11, a branch of the Midianites. Now, Van der Torn says, the strength of the Kenite hypothesis is the link it establishes between different but converging sets of data. The absence of Yahweh from West Semitic epigraphy, inscriptions, Yahweh's topographical link with the area of Edom, which may be taken to include the territory of the Midianites, the Kenite affiliation of Moses, and the positive evaluation of the Kenites in the Bible. So he says, all that makes sense. And he adds, a major flaw in the classical Kenite hypothesis, however, is its disregard for the Canaanite origins of Israel. The view that under the influence of Moses, the Israelites became Yahwists during their journey through the desert, and then brought their newly acquired religion, that's questionable, I hope you're following there, because it intentionally separates Yahweh from who the Israelites were worshiping while they were slaves in Egypt. But again, that's mainstream scholarship. They're going to say that El and El Shaddai, El this and that, you know, in the patriarchal narratives of the Bible, that was a different deity than Yahweh. Okay, because again, they're assuming polytheism here. They're assuming lots of things. So let me repeat that sentence of Van der Torn. The view that under the influence of Moses, the Israelites became Yahwist during their journey through the desert and then brought their newly acquired religion to the Palestinian soil neglects the fact that the majority of the Israelites were firmly rooted in Palestine. The historical role of Moses, moreover, is highly problematic. It seems more prudent not to put too much weight on the figure of Moses. It is only in later tradition that he came to be regarded as the legendary ancestor of the Levitical priests and a symbol of the Yahweh alone movement. His real importance remains uncertain. If the Kenite hypothesis is to be maintained, then it is only in a modified form. It's highly plausible that the Kenites and the Midianites, and he includes the Rechavites, and we didn't even get into them, may be mentioned in the same breath. Perhaps they introduced Israel to the worship of Yahweh. It is unlikely, though, that they did so outside the borders of Palestine. So he's a skeptic, you know, of this. If Yahwism did originate with the Midianites and Kenites, and the evidence seems to point in that direction, it may have been brought to the Transjordan, you know, brought to Edom and these other places by traders along the caravan routes from south to east. You might think, well, that's kind of a wild card. Where does he get that idea? Well, we're gonna bring this passage up a little bit later. He gets it from the Joseph story. Who was it that took, you know, Joseph into Egypt? And again, you know, think about where Jacob and his sons were. I mean, they're up north in, you know, quote unquote Palestine or Canaan or Israel. Okay, they're in that area, and who is Joseph, you know, sold to? The Midianite caravan the Midianite travelers, also called Ishmaelites. So what Van der Torn is saying is, look, this is probably how the name Yahweh got into this region. That this is his view. So he's skeptical of the Kenite hypothesis that Yahweh, as a deity, and his worship originated. That's the key word, originated in this area south of Palestine. He doubts that, even though he knows the data is there, and he knows the Bible connects these places with Moses and Midian and all that kind of stuff. He thinks, he's arguing that the name got there by some other means. He's not going to deny that this is consistent with Yahweh coming from the south. And that's an important, idea, even from, somebody that we'll call, again, I don't know if he's an unbeliever or who knows, who knows where any of these people are at, unless you actually have a conversation with them. But someone who, again, is quite willing, to assign less historicity to this stuff than a lot of people listening to this podcast. But that's still an important point. That's entirely plausible. And that's going to factor into the whole question of Moses learning about Yahweh, from the people in this region, as though he would have had no idea who the God of his fathers and his forefathers was, or that the Israelites down there in Egypt were worshiping some deity. And then they flip deities. They change deities. Oh, we're going to get rid of the El stuff, We're not going to worship the God of Abraham anymore, El Shaddai. We're going to go to this Yahweh, this new one. Okay, if what Van der Torn is suggesting, that this name was circulating around even down into Egypt, the Joseph story, and then winds up in this area, this region, that's significant. Because it undermines this notion of a polytheistic deity flipping later on when you get to Moses. So I'm hoping that that rings, rings a bell in your head. So let's try to, just wrap up and assess the Kenite hypothesis part of this episode now. For someone who doesn't believe that there was a real Moses or an Exodus, the biblical material about Yahweh from the south and the external Egyptian material gives them a Yahweh origin explanation. It does that for them. They might complain that it isn't entirely accurate, like Van der Torn did. They might have that complaint. They might see some conflict with other biblical material, maybe something else archaeologically, but they don't care. Who cares? They're not looking to harmonize anything. They're just, they're nuts and bolts, kind of people. They would say the Bible's not accurate on other things anyway, so who cares? But for them, it gives them kind of a working explanation for how Yahweh became known, because he is not. The name is not in any West Semitic text, any Canaanite, Israelite, that part of the world, north, of Midian and Edom and all that stuff. The Bible, the name Yahweh is not found in any inscription, in that part of the world earlier than the Moabite inscription, which is 900 BC, which is the time of the Amorite dynasty, Jehu, that bunch, So, you say, well, we have the Old Testament. Yes, we do. That's a literary source. But they're saying, look, if this is just odd, if the Israelites come into Canaan, real early, 1200 for the late daters, 1200 BC, 1400 BC for the early daters, it's kind of unusual. We wouldn't see the name pop up anywhere. Not a seal, not an inscription, nothing. I mean, again, it's thousands of times, in the Bible. But again, for scholars who either don't regard the Bible as a historical text, or they don't think it any more significant than any of these other historical texts, this is a chronological oddity to them. So the Kenite hypothesis helps them understand, or at least have a working model for how the name Yahweh would have been known in this part of the world prior to 900 BC. Okay, so that it does that for them. The real question, though, for us is, for those of us who do believe in a historical Moses and who have a high view of Scripture, does the Kenite hypothesis pose a problem? And this takes us to some questions that I think are required for good thinking, coherent thinking about the data we've just covered. In other words, what we want to do is we want to think about the data and ask, well, what do the data say and what don't they say? Because we don't want to just fill in gaps with our imagination. All right, what do they say? What do they not say? And how do we think well about the data that we have? So here are just, again, some questions that are important. Does the Bible, now think about this, does the Bible require that Moses knew the name of Yahweh before he flees to Midian. See, now we assume that as readers and as, you know, in the Christian tradition, you know, what little of the Old Testament actually gets taught to people, you know, most of what people know about the Old Testament they get from movies. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's kind of true. So we assume this, that if, well, of course, Moses, you know, he's a little boy, they've got the little, you know, basket, and he gets rescued, and, you know, it's just a wonderful story, and, you know, he gets raised in Pharaoh's household, but he's weaned by his mom, and he knows he's a Hebrew. Of course, you know, he knows about Yahweh. Really? Does the Bible require that Moses knew the name of Yahweh before fleeing to Midian? Okay, Moses is taken from his mother when he is weaned, 2 or 3 years old. He is raised in Pharaoh's household. Now, somehow, we aren't told. Again, this is the key idea. What does Scripture actually tell us, and what do we sort of mentally fill in culturally? Okay, we're not told how Moses learned that he was a Hebrew. It's evident that he does know that, you know, because he, you know, the argument that he breaks up and then he kills an Egyptian, you know, we know the story, okay? But we're not told how he knows that. And we are never told that he knows the name of Yahweh. How would he? It's not like he's going to Yahweh class, you know, an early release from Egyptian school every day. He's raised in Pharaoh's household. What do you think they're going to teach him? They're not going to teach him about Yahweh. Chances are actually good he would never have heard the name. They're not letting their little boy, their little, you know, little Egyptian boy now, go off and observe Sabbath with a bunch of slaves. How would he know? I would suggest to you that the Bible doesn't require that he knew it. All that we know that he knew is that he knows he's a Hebrew, and he doesn't like what he's seeing, and he gets in trouble, and he has to flee the country. That's what we know. Second, if Moses did not know the name, again, which is an assumption, but it's not an unreasonable one, does that mean he didn't worship the God of his ancestors? This is kind of in the same bucket. Did Moses know about the God of his ancestors, and did he, like, in his heart of hearts, worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? See, we assume that too, to some extent. You know, well, surely Charlton Heston, you know, would have done, you know, come on. We just don't know. We don't know. We don't know about Moses' spiritual condition or his spiritual knowledge at all until we hit Exodus 3. And God basically punches him in the nose, okay? We just don't know. Third, if Moses didn't know the name Yahweh before the burning bush, does that mean he had no religion at all? I mean, that goes with the second one, with the one we just read. Again, we just don't know these things. The Bible doesn't require all the, catch what I'm going to say here. The Bible doesn't require all of the things that critical scholars think the Kenite hypothesis overturns. You know, I'll say it again. The Bible does not require all of the things that critical scholars think the Kenite hypothesis overturns. It just doesn't. And so this is a manufactured problem on one level. It really is. But again, you don't let, I don't want to cast this like it's a conflict or a fight here, but when you're talking about interpretation of Scripture, do not let your opponent insert details and get you to fight over them when they're not there. Okay, that's what happens in a lot of these debates. Fourth, if the name Yahweh was revealed for the first time to any of the line of Jacob, you know, Israel, for the first time at Sinai, and that would be Moses. Okay, so we're assuming in this question that the slaves in Egypt, they've never heard of the name Yahweh either. Again, because, based on what Van der Toorn says, that may not be true because of the caravans and all that kind of stuff, and Joseph going down into Egypt, and of course, you know, generations later, they wind up as slaves. You would think somebody knew this, but let's just go with it here. If the name Yahweh was revealed for the very first time to anybody in Jacob's line, to anybody in Israel, does that mean they were not worshiping the same deity even without that name? I would suggest to you, no, it doesn't mean that. What it means is that the two lines of Abraham, remember, one's down in Egypt, Jacob. The other line of Abraham through Esau, they're in this Midian, Edom, Seir, Paran area. Okay, that's where they live. You got two lines of Abraham. So what this would mean is that you have one line of Abraham down in Egypt. And let's just assume for the sake of the question, they've just lost everything. They've lost all historical memory. Or not all historical memory, but if they ever heard the name of Yahweh, they've forgotten it generations ago, and now they're slaves, blah, 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 blah. And if there's this caravan where you got a few Semites like Joseph, who knew the name, Joseph's memory is history. Who knows about this guy Joseph anymore? And if you know about Joseph, you're not talking about Joseph's knowledge of the name Yahweh. You're talking about the things he did to save people from starvation and whatnot. Let's just assume that nobody down in Egypt knows the name Yahweh. And when the Exodus 3 event is the first time that they hear it, that's only part of Abraham's lineage. Okay, they would have known about their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And maybe they knew, chances are really good here, that they knew of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's God by an El name, El Shaddai, El Olam, something like that, something in the patriarchal narratives. So that's what they know. But the other side of Abraham's lineage, they would know the name Yahweh. Because that much of the Kenite hypothesis, again, that makes that a plausible argument. So that's really what it would come down to. If this is the first time anybody from Jacob's line hears the name of Yahweh, we can't necessarily conclude that they weren't worshiping the same God, because they both could quite easily be worshiping the same deity of their same forefathers. Both of these lines come from the same source, Abraham. Now, we have it divided after that, okay? You've got Isaac. Ishmael, of course, is the non-promised seed. But there are even promises about Ishmael. He'll become 12 princes and blah. They go settle, again, where the Midianites, all the South Arabia. Okay, is it unreasonable to think that the Ishmaelites would not have known about El or El Shaddai or El, one of these Abraham names for God? At that, it's quite reasonable that they did, because that vocabulary is in South Arabia. And so is the name Yahweh. Again, that's the whole Kenite thing. So it's very conceivable they would have been worshiping the same deity, but with different names, different terminology. Now, this sort of raises a sub-question. Let's say that scenario is the case. We would still wonder, well, why would Abraham's other line, the Esau line, the Ishmael line, or whatever, okay, where would they come up with the name Yahweh? Because they didn't have a burning bush experience. Okay, where does the name come from? Now, in South Semitic, again, languages that are in Midian and Edom and Paran and all these areas and the Arabian Peninsula, there are a number of possibilities here, and you could read DDD's entry on Yahweh and get all of them. But I think one of the more reasonable is the South Semitic root HYW. It means he blows, and it refers to wind, like a storm. Okay, you could very easily see that the God of the mountain, think of storm clouds over the mountain and lightning flashing, like you would have had in this region. And then this is a mountainous region. Again, we read that material last week. You could very easily see that if you're in the mountainous region of Seir, okay, Edom, these places, and you've got these storms that come up and right there, in association with the mountain, the mountainous area there, that you could, you would think as an ancient person, as an ancient person, they're thinking that this frightening weather is caused by the gods or God. And you could very easily see how they could name the god after the windstorm idea. And if they did, there you have the consonants right there in South Arabia. Now, we know when Moses has his encounter. Again, Moses is from the other half of Abram's lineage, okay, in our little, you know, sort of thought experiment here. Moses is from the other half, and he gets confronted, and in West Semitic, in Hebrew, it doesn't mean he blows. That's a different language. It's a Semitic language, but it's a different, you know, it's another dialect of Semitic. In Hebrew, it means to be. It's from the to be verb, just like Exodus 3 tells us. So at that point, they're both worshiping the same deity who has the same name, even though, in this scenario, the etymology, the derivation of the name comes from two different ideas. Again, all of these things are on the table. They are all parts, either collectively or partially, of a coherent explanation that doesn't require the Israelites showing up in Midian behind Moses and saying, well, you want us to switch gods? Okay, we'll do that. Can you, that kind of thinking, even though it's common in critical scholarly circles, overstates the data dramatically. And it fails to consider alternatives that are workable with the data. So we need to be thinking more carefully about this. To leave the thought experiment alone, what I just want to have you go away from or go away with, you know, in this part of the episode is that, look, you know, we have this data, certain people draw certain conclusions from it. And what I want you to realize is that those conclusions are not necessarily valid. And in some cases, they're not necessarily even coherent because they are either sort of repackaging the data and including some things that aren't really there, or they're just dramatically overstating the implications of the data. And one of the flaws, again, is to assume certain things about Moses that the text never tells us. These are all, you know, In the bucket of silence, you know, when it comes to scripture, what Moses knew, who knew what and when, and all, again, these are guesses that are part of Christian tradition, part of Jewish tradition. I mean, they are certainly a part of those traditions. But when you just actually look at the text, you don't get some of those things. And some of those things are important, you know, when you're looking at something like the Kenite hypothesis. I would say none of this material is a threat to those who believe in a historical Moses or the Exodus. We have to remember the Bible describes, you know, what the Bible does describe with respect to these people. Nobody has a Bible, folks. Both sides of Abraham's line have a handful of stories about a deity whom their ancestor Abraham encountered or who encountered him, and they hand down those stories orally. The people of both sides of Abraham's lineage worship his God. This deity had many El names. One of them was El Shaddai, God of the mountains, God of the wilderness. Is it really a stretch to think that one line of descent, you know, from Abraham and the other line that winds up in Edom and Seir and Midian? Is it really a stretch to think that one line of descent also described El Shaddai as Yahweh, even if the name that they chose in the South Arabian dialect comes from he blows, you know, the blowing of the wind, again, the storm god? Is that really a stretch? Well, no, it's not. You know, we don't know, you know, how the name, you know, would have developed in one dialect, you know, the other, the Western Northwest Semitic dialect we get from Exodus 3. You know, we get more information there. We get textual information there. But on the other side, all we have to do is wonder, you know, where they would have come up with that name without the text in their life context. You know, people assign things like weather, like I said, to the power of the gods. Well, God, Moses has his divine encounter with the God of his fathers at the burning bush somewhere near Midian, in the wilderness, at a mountain. Okay. Either Moses or the later biblical writer take HWY in South Semitic. Maybe they knew about the South Semitic derivation, and they quote unquote convert it to West Semitic Hebrew, where it means to be. Again, that's entirely possible. There we go. You could actually have the biblical writer transforming the Kenite, Midianite, Southern Semitic name to reflect the circumstances of the God who is about to make himself a new nation or people after the deliverance of from Egypt, specifically of the other, i.e. the Jacobite line from Abraham that is now released from Egypt. All of this is on the table. It can all make sense, and it can be quite consistent with a historical Moses and an Exodus. You don't need to pick one or the other. So don't let yourself be forced into these sorts of conclusions or be troubled by them. You just need to think better about the material.
All right. Well, we're going to stop it right there. And I know that's not nice of me, but next week, I promise y'all, it will not disappoint as we get into the weirder side of things, including the Watchers and connecting those dots with Exodus 3. Also, I just wanted to let y'all know that our website issues are behind us since the last week or two. I put it off for so long to do a lot of the back end stuff that I needed to do, and it was finally time to do it, only because I knew it would break a bunch of stuff. But I think we got through it, so we appreciate everybody's patience during that ordeal. But let me know if you're still experiencing some issues. Hopefully, everything is 100% back to normal. And one more thing, real quickly, for all of our iTunes listeners, it doesn't matter which country you're in, but if you use iTunes, please, every single one of y'all, if you would take a few seconds out of your time to leave us a review and rate us, we would greatly appreciate that. Doing so helps other folks find our show, and that would be a very great thing. And I want to thank all of our iTunes listeners for doing so. And I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.